All right, as always, good to see everybody here this morning. We are studying our harmony and into page 106, which will be in John 6. I sometimes find myself wondering, since we are told that God is no respecter of persons, and we are not supposed to be respecters of persons either, if there's a problem with being a respecter of scriptures. I love this sixth chapter of John. Just one of my all-time favorite places in all of the Gospels there. There's something about, I think, just the activity of this particular chapter that appeals to me. But, of course, we also have a number of statements that are fascinating, to say the least. And so John being the only writer who gives us this information, we have this very unique insight into the moment, really, when Jesus is at the height of his popularity. As we'll be seeing, it is in the events of John 6 that Jesus is just universally acclaimed by the people, though he certainly has his enemies among the Pharisees. He is going to be turning a corner here pretty soon, as this is a challenging chapter for the material that he presents as well. Now, as you look at the screen, I'm going to have to appeal to Ted to work his magic finger here for a few minutes, because I apparently left the switch on last week, so the battery's dead and no one's out running for a AAA. Is there anybody here who has a AAA battery in a purse? I know guys never carry them in their wallets. I'm disappointed. I've seen whole emergency rooms come out of persons before. But surely they're good. Sometimes you watch those Harry Potter movies. I think a woman's purse can be like some of the stuff you see in the Harry Potter movies, where you open up a purse and find a 20-room mansion inside. Okay, so let's go then to this area which you saw last week as we were getting set up for this material. Jesus is the man from Galilee. He's performing most of his miracles and presenting most of his sermons up in this area. He'll spend the longest time there. And then Ted, if you'll go ahead and hit the button again, showed him last week. He had gone over to this area, apparently, that is alongside, and look carefully, just to the right of the source of that arrow, where the Jordan River jumps into a little delta there at the north end of the Sea of Galilee. So he was in this region. There are several Bethsaidas in the New Testament. He was up by one of those, spent the night in prayer, walked across the water, as we saw last week, meeting the apostles. Okay, the next arrow there. It tells us that the apostles are against the wind, having problems with the storm. They're trying to row anywhere from about 3.5 to 6.5 miles. And we don't know exactly where they land in the plain of Gennesaret, but the arrowheads that you see on the chart represent the furthest reaches along the coastline anyway, that little area that's known as the plain of Gennesaret, or sometimes called the plain of Gennesar. So he's just somewhere in that area, but he's always perambulating, to use the fancy term. He is always moving around, and so we're finding that he's being kind of chased around as well. So as we come now to verse 22, in John chapter 6, they're about the middle of page 106. Thank you. So let's go in here. Looks like we're in good shape. Okay, this next picture will be an aerial shot. Farrell Jenkins and I were in an aircraft flying down the Jordan River there, and we're looking along the site of that arrow right there in this picture. So in this picture, you can see in the far distance that shoreline. I think I've got a view right here. This is Tiberias right here. The plain of Gennesaret is that little area right there. And right along in here is where you have Capernaum. And just above it, slightly out of sight right there, is where the Sermon on the Mount would have taken place. And so this is the region where Jesus spends most of his time. And this line right through here, or from here, you know, over to the plain, somewhere like that, it is where the apostles had been rowing in the great event of walking on the water for Peter's sake took place. But now look at verse 22. And the next day, the multitude that stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other small boat there except one, that Jesus had not entered with his disciples into the boat, but that his disciples had gone away alone. There came other small boats from Tiberias near to the place where they ate the bread after the Lord had given thanks. When the multitude therefore saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they themselves got into the small boat and came to Capernaum seeking Jesus. So what we're going to do now is the next slide will take us up here to Tiberias, and along that arrow sight line again. On page 106, is the view from Tiberias that you got here in the foreground on the hillside, looking across to that shoreline where, right off over here, the Jordan River melts into the water. So we just come across the other side. This was a significant city in the time of Jesus. It's a significant city on the shore of the Sea of Galilee now. And so multitudes of people are living there full time. Jesus is spending most of his time just a matter of a few miles away there. And so he is being pursued. The lake is significant, though. 7.5 miles wide from Tiberias across to the Jordan River. It's 7.5 miles wide, just from left to right at that point as well. 13 miles long. Very significant body of water. And so these people have a lot of shoreline up there to be hunting along. So again, let me just point out, here's the Jordan River jumps in. Capernaum is going to be about right in there. The Sermon on the Mount is just a hill up above it. And the Plain of Gennesaret is this area right here. But as you look now at page 108, I guess it is, yes, up toward the top there at verse 59, at the end of this section in John 6, 59, these things he said in the synagogue as he taught where? In Capernaum. So for all these people that are chasing him around, for all of the back and forth that they've had, both in boats and on the land, Jesus now has come to Capernaum, which he is calling his hometown. And in these verses now, 6:25 through 71, this will be our last chart, and we'll have a look at it, you're going to come across four questions and three major gripes, and then one spectacular declaration from a man of faith. So we've got quite a bit of varying kinds of information. First, we have a series of questions that are rather neutral or even favorable to Jesus, people seeking information. Then you've got his opposers. They're as angry as they can be, and you get a sort of back-and-forth gun battle that goes on for a while. That's my favorite part. And then you get down to this declaration again, as we'll see in just a moment. So, you're well aware we have different class times while we're in here, and the classes are shortened. So we're just going to be looking this morning at verses 25 through 71 in John chapter 6, starting there on page 106. And, back to page, so I get there myself. Now, verse 25, we have the first of these questions. When they found him on the other side of the sea, somewhere, you know, there, and he's on his way to Capernaum. Rabbi, when did you get here? And Jesus answered them and said, truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man shall give to you, for on him the Father, even God, has set his seal. So tell me, what was the answer to their question? What's the question? When did you get here? What's the answer? I don't care to respond to that question. I've got other things on my mind. And so, Jesus just does not answer that question at all. But he's probably getting to the root of why they're asking such a question. These multitudes of people chasing after him in all directions, and boats and on foot, and especially coming over now from Tiberias, these people Jesus knows are after him for the wrong reasons. They are after him because he fed the 5,000 over there the day before at Bethsaida. Throughout the night, I take it, while Jesus was praying and as he's walking on the water itself, these people have like ants, you know, in the nest, been just telling everybody around the Sea of Galilee about those events. Now, we've got a man on our hands who can solve all of our physical problems. He can heal our every disease. He can fill our bellies on demand. 5 loaves and 2 fish can feed thousands and then take up 12 baskets left over. This is a pretty cool guy. And what do we want out of him? We want physical stuff. We want physical healing. We want physical bread. Lord, when did you get here? Don't do this to us again, maybe as a part of their question. You know, we want constant access. And Jesus doesn't answer any of those concerns. He essentially attacks them. Rabbi, when did you get here? Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled. Now, brethren, what do signs do? Stamenon is the Greek term here. It's really important in your New Testament studies. We're coming to an unusual facility here. Last week, left my house, wasn't going to our regular building, wasn't paying attention, and I missed the turnoff. So I had to go down to the next off-ramp and come in from the east. No big deal, I added 60 seconds, you know, to the journey. But there's a sign out there on the freeway. Is the sign my destination? No. The sign is not all that important, except for what? What it points at. If I miss the sign, the significance of the sign, and don't respond properly to the sign, what happens to my life? It's the long way around. What it was last week. And when Jesus is out working miracles, what is he doing? He's just digging post holes and putting up signs. Now, if everybody says, wow, that's the most amazing sign I ever saw. I didn't tell all my friends about the sign. And then we're all going to huddle here around the sign. What do you got? You got just a huge mistake. It's not the sign that's the big deal. It's the reason why I give you that sign. It's what the sign represents. It's something else that the sign is pointing at. And you people are not getting it. So when they ask this question, you would think, you know, if you give them the benefit of the doubt in all honesty, they're still missing the point. You ate the loaves. That's the sign. And you're filled. But verse 27, do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man shall give to you, for on him the Father, even God, has set his seal. Now, you need physical food? Of course you do. Is there anything wrong with filling your belly? Not a thing in the world. Should you get excited if somebody could, you know, give you endless meal? Well, yeah, I probably would too. But that's still only a sign about far more important things. Spiritual things. Eternal things. Therefore, lasting things. So don't work for the food which perishes. Don't be so concerned about the carnal stuff, the material stuff. It's important. You've got to be involved in it, but it's not the first order of importance. The Son of Man, but work for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you, for on him the Father, even God, has set his seal. Now, a little bit of a technical aside here. Raise your hand if you've ever heard the expression, the not but construction. Okay, got to hit a point here. All right. In the Greek, and in English, and I suppose in every language on the planet, you have to be really careful about figures of speech. Jesus gives an absolute command in verse 27. Do not work for the food which perishes. Now, how many of you have jobs and you work for food? Yeah. Learning anything, you've got to quit that job. You can't be a member of the church until you go completely worthless. Because Jesus forbid that, didn't he? Did he not say, do not work for the food that perishes? Only a handful of you, James, the one honest one in the room, come on, do it. The rest of you guys are all hiding. Okay, we're all doing it. Okay, well, he said that. And if you look at it out of context, ignore everything else that follows, you're not familiar with some of these expressions, then yes, it could be taken as a direct command. So, and a lot of religious groups do, in a lot of other passages, we're not going to get into all of that. Whenever you read a sentence that says, not this, and then it's followed by, but this. So in 27, do not work for the food which perishes, there's the not, and then it says, but for the food which endures to eternal life. The contrast is not between an absolute prohibition and an absolute command. And you may never have this, and you must only have that, despite the fact that is what the words say. But when you have that kind of construction, not this, but that, you immediately need to have that flag go up and say, well, wait a minute. This is a standard, colloquial expression that is not absolutely forbidding the first part. What it's trying to do, and in memory of all our talk here about signs, is what? Emphasize what follows. You have to work for the food which perishes. But this is more important, the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man shall give you, for on him the Father, even God, has set his seal. By the way, God set a seal on Jesus. Give me another word in this context for seal. What is the seal that God set on Jesus? The signs. What is a seal? When the king has the special ring and the signet, you know, has his particular symbol and he presses it down into the wax, what is he doing? He's making a sign that tells everybody that this letter has the king's authority. God put a seal on Jesus. He's identifying ownership and authority. But in the context, what are we talking about? It's the miracles. The people are getting caught up in supernatural powers and not appreciating the message that Jesus is presenting and proving that it comes from God by virtue of the miracles. That's question number one. When did you get here? Number two is in 28. They said therefore to him, what shall we do that we may work the works of God? Now, brother, near as I can tell, that is a wonderful and great, perfect question. Jesus is not going to be upset with this at all. This is a question we always ought to be asking. What shall we do? How can I be involved? What should I as an individual, forget about everybody else, be doing? That we may work the works of God. What are God's works that he wants done? We don't want to be inventing any of our own. We just want to do what the Lord would ask us to do. Great question. And in 29, Jesus answered and said to me, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. That's what the purpose of the miracles was, to identify that Jesus is the Son of the living God, that he's been sent by God, that his message is what's important. These are the words into eternal life. So when you want to do the work of God, here's the words you should get about doing. Believe in him whom God has sent. Now, if you're notator, this is a profoundly important verse. Somehow you want to remember John chapter 6 and verse 29. You want to mark it in your regular study Bible. So if you're out talking to people, you'll be able to find it. What is, according to Jesus the Christ, Son of the living God, the work that we're supposed to be doing? And these people ask, here's an answer. That answer's going to stand the test of time. It continues down to this day. What is the work that we're supposed to be doing? Believe. What's another word for belief?
Faith.
Faith, then, according to Jesus, in verse 29, is a what?
Work.
It is a work. Faith is a what?
Work.
Say it again. Faith is a
work.
Should I be saved by faith and not by works? According to the entire denominational world, our religious world, you know, in America today, they completely misunderstood Paul's epistles. They completely misunderstood Ephesians chapter 2, just for instance, which we are saved by grace through faith, and that not of ourselves. True enough. But does that mean that faith is the opposite or the antithesis, and never the twain shall meet, with works? No. And if we're going to be saved by faith, then according to verse 29, what are you being saved by?
Work.
The work that what was specifically their question that you may do that comes from God. So at the very outset, when Jesus first starts teaching about faith in John chapter 6, does Jesus set up this false contrast and even contradiction between faith and works that our religious world has somehow managed to acquire today? Quite the exact opposite. Faith is a work. Faith is a work that you are supposed to do. And faith is the work of God that He asks us to be performing. So when they ask, what shall we do that we may work the works of God? The denominational world's answer is, there is no work that you should be doing. You are not saved by works. They're just absolutely contradicting this verse and have no idea, you know, that they're up to that. So it's a foundationally important verse in helping people to appreciate your friends and neighbors that faith and works are not enemies, that faith is a work, that without it you cannot be saved. And the whole purpose of the miracles was to direct people to Jesus, Son of the Living God, so that we would get busy in that work to start with, and a host of others as well. So in verse 30, they said therefore to him, question number 3, what then do you do for a sign that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform? Now, brethren, at this point, I think you'll see Jesus' response here, too. At this point, I can just imagine Jesus must be so exasperated. What did he do with the first question? He criticized them for having an entirely wrong attitude when it comes to the signs. In between the first and third questions, they ask this wonderful question, what's the work we ought to be doing? Here it is. Believe what I'm telling you. And therefore get out and practice it as well. And what do they write back to in the next breath at verse 30? It said therefore to him, what did you do for a sign that we may see and believe you? What work did you perform? What was he doing yesterday with the 5,000? Why did they chase him around the lake all night? Why was Tiberias so empty in the morning? Everybody had ran through the plain of Gennesaret and cornered him there in Capernaum because of the signs that he was doing. And so now, brethren, it looks to me like maybe they're a little bit embarrassed. Then they're kind of coming back to defend themselves a little bit and saying, you know, well, what's the work you want us to do then? As if Jesus, you know, hadn't been teaching this before. And so in 31, Jesus says, they continue. Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, he gave them bread out of heaven to eat. Why did they quote that verse? Second guess them. What do you think?
Still wanted food.
They just wanted to know what's on the menu. Exactly. Yeah. They're suggesting we're hungry. What have they been doing this morning? Chasing Jesus around the lake. Okay, so they're saying, it's dinner time, and you just told them. That's not the important thing. Well, in 32, Jesus therefore said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it is not Moses who's giving you the bread out of heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread out of heaven. For the bread of God is that which comes down out of heaven and gives life to the world. Now you think about the verses we've just read and answer the question, what is the bread that gives life to the world? Verse 27. What did Jesus say? Do not work for food which perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of God, Son of Man rather, shall give to you, for on him the Father, even God, has set his seal. I can't believe that they're not getting this. Jesus must be feeling the same thing. So we're right back where we started. The bread that comes down out of heaven, the reason I'm working the signs, what you should be chasing after, are my words unto eternal life. And here you are again, asking for another meal. In 34, they said therefore to him, Lord, evermore give us this bread. So for a question, doesn't sound like a question, give us, but it is, you know, Lord, give us the bread to eat. Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger. He who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you've seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me shall come to me, and the one who comes to me I will certainly not cast out. For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that of all that he has given me, I lose nothing, but raise it up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him may have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up on the last day. Now, just like with the first question, does that address their request at all? The answer is yes and no. Is it the right answer to their question? We want the bread of eternal life. Okay, then pay attention to what I say, and I'll raise you up, he says twice, on the last day. He mentions resurrection. You'll have eternal life. But it all is contingent upon what I'm telling you. But did he answer their question? Lord, Moses gave us man out of heaven. Did they get man out of heaven? Physically. No. Does Jesus answer that question? Already had. He wasn't happy with them about it either. And so, you know, it's just no. Then, in verse 41, the gun battle began. I have to be careful to check my times here just so I get this right. Okay, perfect. Alright, so, let the battle begin. The Jews, therefore, were grumbling in verse 41 because he said, I am the what? I'm the bread. You're missing the point. I'm the bread. I will raise you up on the last day. I'm the one behind the resurrection. The work you need to be doing is believing what I said. God sent me. Can't you get this? You can hear Jesus thinking. And then the Jews, they hear this, and no, we are not buying this now. So they were saying in 42, is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, I've come down out of heaven? And Jesus answered and said to them, do not grumble among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. That's the third time we hear about a last day and a resurrection. But now, brethren, while we're reading these next verses, please try to the best of your ability to put yourself on those aerial photographs we were just looking at. To physically think about yourself and your relationship with Jesus the Christ, Son of the Living God. Think about His gospel, His words, the things He teaches. When He says in 44, no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I'll raise him up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, they shall all be taught of God. Isaiah 54. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that any man has seen the Father, except the one who is from God. He has seen the Father. Who's that? It's Jesus himself. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread, he's now referring to the bread that he gives them unto eternal life, which he is. This is the bread which comes down out of heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. Now, should you work for physical food? Jesus said not to, but should you? Yes, because there's a contrast between this other, what he teaches, that is unto eternal life. 51. I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he shall live forever. and the breath also, which I shall give for the life of the world, is my flesh. Now, we got a couple more minutes, quite a few verses I still want to cover. Is this about the Lord's Supper that we're going to be partaking of in a few minutes? No, it is not. It is not. Is it appropriate to use these verses for the Lord's Supper, though, you Lord's Supper leaders? Certainly I think so. I see it all the time, and I've done it myself. Be careful, because there are overlapping ideas here. But it's not about the Lord's Supper. What's it about? Two things, and please take note, brethren, I think it's pretty significant, that in verse 51, he says, I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread what? What's the next word? And the bread also, which I shall give for the life of the world, is what? My flesh. Up to that point, and before the word also, what's the only thing Jesus has been talking about when it comes to bread? What he preaches. You should chase after me, just like you've been doing, but not for physical food. Listen to what I teach. Work the works of God. Believe me. Up to that point. But then he adds that word also in verse 51. And the bread also which I shall give for the life of the world is what? In addition to what I'm teaching, what else am I also going to do? I'm going to die on that cross, aren't I? That's what he's saying. So the Jews in 52 began to argue with one another, saying, well, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Jesus therefore said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in yourselves. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life. How did you get it in the preceding verses? Eternal life. How did you get it? Believe what he taught. Eating his flesh and drinking his blood here is a reference to the things he taught. I will raise him up on the last day. That's the fourth time in verse 54 that he mentions that resurrection. For my flesh is true food, my blood is true drink. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. As the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so he who eats me shall also live because of me. This is the bread which came down out of heaven, not as the fathers ate and died. He who eats this bread shall live forever. And these things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. It is confusing. Similar language is used about the Lord's Supper. Jesus did use the word also. He's talking about two different things. What he said in his sacrifice on the cross. Is his sacrifice on the cross good for anything if we don't believe what he and the apostles teach? It's good for nothing. Okay? He is trying to disabuse them of the search for physical food. He's trying to encourage them into the search for spiritual food, what he preaches and teaches himself through the apostles and prophets. And in so doing, meant as a side reference, and I'm going to die to accomplish this. Okay? Now final section, and we'll be done right on time. 60. Many, therefore, of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it? Jesus, conscious that his disciples grumbled at this, said to them, does this cause you to stumble? What then if you should behold the Son of Man ascending where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I have spoken to you are what?
Spirit.
And they are life. That's next, I think the third, these phenomenally important statements in this section in John 6. Highlight verse 63, I don't have time to develop it, but his words are two things. His words are spirit, and they are life. That's how you get to heaven and eternal life. But there are some of you who do not believe, maybe in this room still, certainly then. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were who did not believe and who it was that would betray them. And he was saying, for this reason I've said to you that no one can come to me unless it's been granted him from the Father. And now, brethren, He stands at the pinnacle and starts downhill in popularity at verse 66. As a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. Jesus said, therefore, to the 12, you do not want to go away also, do you? Simon Peter answered, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have words of eternal life. And we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. And Jesus answered them, did I myself not choose you, the 12, and yet one of you is a devil? And he meant Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the 12, was going to betray him. Plenty of times about this, you know, times that I saw it. Let's go. We'll see you next week. Thank you. 10-minute break.